The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
The lives of many people changed on January the 25th, 2013. Families and friends were left broken, children were left without a father, communities were torn apart, and a nation was left horrified upon learning of the death of Detective Garda Adrian Donoghue. He was murdered as he carried out a routine cash escort duty at the Lordship Credit Union in Dundalk in County Louth. A new book describes the efforts to convict those responsible, the international manhunt that took place, and the lengthiest criminal murder trial in the history of the state. As described in the book, while one man's hand was on the gun on that tragic day over 11 years ago, there were many fingers on that trigger. We're joined by the authors of the book, which is called Murder at Lordship, Robin Schiller, Irish independent journalist, and Pat Murray, who's a former detective Garda inspector, who is the senior investigator of Adrian Donoghue's murder case and author of the book The Making of a Detective, which was also, like this one, a bestseller. Good morning and welcome to you both.
Morning.
We'll start with you, Pat, and take us back to that day in January of 2013 and what happened.
Well, the 25th of January 2013 is etched in my mind and I'll never forget it. 9:30 p.m. that evening, I got a phone call from my superintendent to tell me, did you hear about Adrian? And I said, no. And he said, he's dead. He's shot dead. And I was stuck to the floor. I couldn't take it in. I knew what he was saying to me. And he said, I says, what do you mean? He says, it was an armed robbery in Lordship and he was shot dead. And I couldn't take it in. Like, it was like a bolt hitting me, like, you know. And I just said, yeah, I'll be in straight away.
Now, there had been a spate of robberies in the area. So the necessity for guarding relatively small sums of money from the credit unions, relatively small, that had become a routine.
Yes, and a year and a half previous to the 25th of January, there was a similar type robbery at Lordship Credit Union where they got something like 20,000 or whatever, you know. And we had a suspect for that, and that suspect was arrested and questioned by Adrian Donoghue. And it's all in the book, but the modus operandi for that particular job was exactly the same as the modus operandi for the job that where Adrian was killed. So
there was a kind of a convoy, in a sense, coming from another cash pickup, which ended up at Lordship at this particular time.
Yeah,
Lordship. The gang were in wait.
Yeah, there was the last pickup as such, and the gang were waiting for men, masked men were waiting behind the wall, small wall, stone wall at the car park of the credit union. When the cars went to move off in convoy, including the Garda car, which was a plainclothes car, a car came down and blocked the entrance so no car could get out. Adrian Donoghue obviously got out of the car to see what was happening, but at that time the four men got over the wall. Two of them were armed, one with a shotgun, one with a handgun, and ran towards the Garda car.
Now, Adrian got out. Yeah. He had a weapon, but it was still holstered at that point.
It was, yeah.
And it looked like the gunman showed no quarter.
He showed no quarter, and it was an execution. That's what it was. He was shot at point-blank range, really, just the distance off the roof of the car, to 7 feet.
And with a shotgun.
With a shotgun, and he was shot in the face, and it was horrendous, horrendous. Even Joe Ryan at that stage didn't know that his colleague had been shot dead, but he knew a shot had been fired. He thought it was a warning shot or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
And he was threatened then, and the gun put to him and told him he'd be shot, he'd be killed. And in Joe Ryan's mind, and it's in the book, he was thinking, if I'm going to be shot, I hope it's with a handgun. I'd stand
not with the shotgun.
Yeah. So imagine what's going through his mind and the fear and the...
Now, they got away with some money. There was another car in the convoy, which was a cash guy, I think, and it had a lot of money. Well, relatively speaking, 27 grand or something like that.
Yeah.
They didn't even find that.
No, they missed that.
And they made their way 7,000. The life of a man for 7,000.
Oh, yeah. But this is what it done. And the robbery only lasted 58 seconds.
Yeah.
Like, so a man lost his life. It had what the impact of his murder had on not just his family, but on his colleagues that worked for him closely every day and the greater community that he was a part of and the Garda organisation and the general public. Like, it was, everyone was shocked and disgusted.
Trying to get inside the mind of a killer like that, I mean, who shoots a guard knowing the impact of a shotgun, he was committing capital murder.
He was, and that's
and why would someone like do that to themselves? They know that's life, and in this case, life will probably mean a very, very, very long life behind bars.
Well, these guys would think they were never going to be caught. They had everything covered. They're not going to be caught, and they get away. That's it. Or keep your mouth shut, and that's it. But the investigation that ensued was relentless, was professional, was intricate. It was, you know, we followed everything that we possibly could follow.
Okay.
And we had 6,000 lines of inquiry, where the average murder would be around 250 lines of inquiry.
I'll come back to you in a moment about the clues that began to be assembled. Yeah. But Robin, you weren't reporting on this at the time, but you reported on the court case. What attracted your interest in this particular case, besides being a notorious capital murder?
Well, I think that was the first thing. It was a notorious crime, and you know, when it happened in 2013, I was a student in college, but like every decent person was shocked that a member of An Garda Síochána and a decent human being could be shot dead like that. So I focused on it throughout my, I suppose, career in the last 10 years, and when the court case came up, we decided that there was more to it. There was a story here that had to be told, that, you know, there's a lot of reports about it over the years, but to really see, get inside the evidence, the hoops that Gardaí had to jump through, the amount of material that had to be gathered to bring the charges for prosecution. And I think that was all laid bare. We didn't expect the court case going that long. It lasted for 8 months. It survived a COVID pandemic, and it survived serious efforts by Aaron Brady and his associates to intimidate witnesses. But it did survive all that, and I think the jury came to its decision after hearing 8 months of evidence that, beyond reasonable doubt,
Aaron Brady... You write in the book that the gang were kind of meticulous in not leaving fingerprints or DNA behind. So that kind of direct evidence was not available. The state built its case circumstantially.
Yeah, it was a massive circumstantial case, and those bits of evidence alone aren't necessarily enough to prove guilt. But, you know, over a long period of time, over 7 years before that court case, there was, you know, lies by Aaron Brady, false alibis given, CCTV evidence linking him to the theft of the getaway car, mobile phone silent periods. All this really crucial evidence, topped off with his own admissions, was enough to prove that he was guilty of capital murder.
Because when a mobile phone, a man who uses it all the time, and it goes silent for a critical period, that period being the time of the robbery and the getaway, it is not enough in itself. But when you start putting all the pieces of the jigsaw together, it was enough to convince the jury.
Yeah, and even one phone itself being silent for, you know, a 2 hour period isn't unusual itself. But when you have 4 or 5 suspects who are in constant communication up in the lead up to the robbery and murder, their phones all go silent around the same time for 2 hours and all get reactivated again, it is fairly damning evidence. But again, it's not enough. You need the other evidence in the case.
Now, I'll come back to you to talk about the international dimension of the case, but let's start local with Pat Murray. Pat, you had some idea as to who the perpetrators were of this spate of armed robberies. I mean, in general terms, because this was bandit country, Cross Maglen.
Very difficult area to police, both south of the border and north of the border, especially north of the border, because the PSNI wouldn't be overactive in that area. We had a good handle south of the border, but we had an idea who these people were. But how it came to be that Aaron Brady came into the picture was on that night I got two of my detective sergeants and I put them in an office and I said, put your heads together. I want a list of people that have local border accents that would be involved in this type of thing.
How did you know they were local?
Now, they were local, very simple, because I spoke to Joe Ryan, who was with Adrian at the time, and I sat Joe down in my office with another sergeant, and I said, Joe, just in your own words, tell me, just talk to me. And he told me.
Joe had lived for
20 years, he was policing the border.
So he knew, if you came from one townland, another.
He would. And I just said, Joe, what were their accents like? Well, he said, Pat, they weren't traveller accents, they weren't Dublin accents, they weren't Northern accents, they were local border accents, and he was sure of that. So that gave me bump. This is the bit of information I want to get started. So I got my detective sergeants to make up a list of local criminals, subversives that with local border accents that may be involved in this type of thing. And they came back with a list of 12 people. And the third person on the list was Aaron Brady. I then divided the staff that was there into teams of two. And one guy put his hand up and he says, I have Aaron Brady charged with ramming the guards and that, and he's on bail and he's supposed to be staying in a house in Carlingford. And I said, you pick someone there now and that's your team and away you go. And I want...
So this is a guy who'd rammed a guard the car
and
was out on bail?
Yes. Okay. And he had actually pleaded guilty to all of that and was awaiting sentence, but he skipped it to America in the meantime. But anyway, look, the guards went up there to his house and he wasn't there. So he was then a person of interest because he should have been there. He was breaching his bail and he should be there. So
that was enough to lock him up if you could have found him.
Yeah, but look, the next day there was a search on the roadside either side from the credit union to Ballymascanlan roundabout. And the sergeant who had been sent and tasked with looking for Aaron Brady spotted him in a car and stopped the car and took him out of the car and asked him for his movements that the day before and where he was at the time. And he said he was with his girlfriend from half eight that evening, gave her address, gave her name, all this, that and the other. And he said he was with Jimmy Flynn, who was in the car with him. And Jimmy Flynn was taken out and spoken to out of earshot of Aaron Brady. And he gave a different story, like there was inconsistencies. Now, the sergeant put it all on paper and gave it to me. And I read it. Said, here's a guy now that wasn't at home. And here he is now. Their story's not matching
why
up.
Why were they not arrested on the spot?
No, you can't.
I'm taken in. No, I mean, you had a capital murder had taken place.
Oh, yeah, but you have to have evidence. You have to have evidence to put to them.
Do they bring people in for questioning? No, a lot of the time, don't they?
No, they'll arrest, you have to have reasonable cause to suspect. And at that stage, in my mind, there wasn't any reasonable cause to suspect that he was a suspect.
Because I'm just
he
thinking,
was a person of interest.
Had he been arrested that night and taken in?
Yeah, he'd sit there for
a day. He would not have been able to scarper to America, as
well,
he did.
I'd say he would, because he would have been that we wouldn't have had enough to charge him or that. And we wouldn't have enough material to put to him. And it was a long game. This was the long game. And you don't, as an investigator, you don't jump. You analyse everything. You see where you're at. There wasn't enough to arrest
so
him.
So it's not a question of round up the usual suspects?
No, absolutely not. Absolutely not.
You mention in the book, and it comes from you, Pat, more than from Robin, who recounts it in the text, that the fact that Adrian Donoghue did not have an Uzi.
Yes,
he
absolutely.
Had a, what was it, a Sig Sauer or something like that?
Yes, a Sig Sauer 15.
Pistol, yeah, in a holster.
Yeah, in a holster. And it was a bone of contention for me because a couple of months before that, my detectives on the border made it quite clear to me that they didn't feel safe patrolling the border without using a machine gun. And I could see their concerns and I could always see where a guard with Uzi demanded respect from criminals and subversives.
Because he wears the Uzi over his shoulder, it's ready to go.
It's ready to go. And it was in all the newspapers, Nevin, that the guards didn't have the Uzi. So I completed a report and sent it up to my authorities on the value of having the Uzi machine gun reinstated to the detectives on the border, in particular in Dundalk. And I gave the reasoning of what, like, you know, the guards are, you know, responsible for state security and all of that, you know, and health and safety, all of that. I covered the whole area and sent it up. And 2 weeks before the murder, it came back down. No, it wasn't, my application wouldn't be entertained. End of story.
Yeah. So no, you believe that if it's not that even Adrian Donoghue might have been brandishing the Uzi, but the fact that he would possess an Uzi might have been a deterrent.
Yeah, they wouldn't have taken on the guards. They wouldn't have taken on the robbery. They wouldn't have taken on they wouldn't have done it.
Let's move to the international dimension of the story then, Robin. I mean, this was, as Pat has mentioned, a very long game.
Yeah, 7 years. And, you know, Aaron Brady knew the writing was on the wall fairly early after that stop by Sergeant John Moroney at the time. He went into the Gardaí, he gave a statement, and he knew himself fairly early on that he was a suspect in the investigation. I think in April 2013, his house is searched. Gardaí find a newly issued British passport. It's fairly clear that he's going to leave, but they can do little about it. They can't seize the documentation. And lo and behold, 5 days later, he boards a flight to America. He initially lives in New York for a few weeks and then goes north to Boston to be with James Flynn, his fellow suspect. They live there for several months. They have a falling out, which naturally happens among these criminals. And he moves back down to New York and begins building a fairly permanent life for himself, believing that he's safe away from the Garda investigation team.
And he was for a while. But then the international dimension, you mention in passing that the NYPD was not necessarily that helpful, but Homeland Security were.
Oh, yeah. Homeland Security were the business. And they sent two special agents over from their London office to Dublin. And I met them in the Ashling Hotel in the foyer there. And I sat down and spoke with them, Scott Crabb and Matt Katsky. and we just hit it off. We hit it off. They could see the emotion and the passion we had to, you know, solve this crime. And they looked on Adrian Donoghue's murder as a murder of one of their own. Like, you know, the police are the same all over the world. They think the same. They have a, you know, they have a common bond, let's say. And that bond I connected with, especially with Matt Katsky, and we developed a good relationship. And
now, was Aaron Brady illegally in the United States?
He was, yeah. He had
overstayed.
Yeah, he was on a 90-day visa and he had overstayed, you know. And he was there in America and he had met a girl, had a baby, living his life, working on construction sites and all that.
And so, could he just have been picked up then by Homeland Security without offending at all because he was already in breach of his holiday visa?
And that's what did happen, and he was brought back to Ireland for breaching his visa. And when he arrived back in Dublin, the guards who were dealing with the ramming of the guards and all that type of stuff arrested him on the domestic home warrants and brought him into custody.
Okay.
And he was sentenced to 6 months. The DPP thought 6 months was too lenient given what he had done, and he was given another 6 months on top of it. So there was a 12 months. He was given 12 months.
You had a window then.
I had a window, and I was delighted because I said I was at the stages, at the nitty gritty, putting this evidence all together, building the case, and on all the times I was in contact with the DPP, and they knew what we had, and they knew what we were doing. You know, so.
You get one go at this, don't you?
Oh yes, you get one go.
If the DPP gives you the go ahead, you have one go.
That's it. That's why you don't panic about arrests or anything like that. You have to think it out. Where you're going with this? What's the end game? Have I got the evidence? How is this evidence going to be put to Aaron Brady? There was a whole strategy in respect of interviewing him when he was brought in and how the evidence that we had was put to him. So that it was done fairly and, you know, legally and all that. So that was all done, and he had a solicitor with him during his interviews and that, you know. So everything was done right. I wouldn't, any of my investigations, I don't fall, the professionalism has to show, because that's where it comes out in trials. If you're slipshod or, you know, you're messy, you will be caught out.
Do you have greater confidence going before the Special Criminal Court rather than a jury court?
No, not given the last verdicts in respect to the other two. But no, look, I think
is it that the justices tend to be very rigorous about the law and about the quality of evidence, the admissibility?
No. I think the first trial of Aaron Brady, I looked to have it put before the Special Criminal Court, and the DPP argued that they felt it would be better going to a body of his peers, like, you know, and, you know, they said there was nothing. I know he's on the border and that, but there's nothing to suggest at this stage, you know, that a normal court.
Yeah, because, I mean, you worry about intimidation of jury members. Yeah, you worry about intimidation of witnesses.
Yeah, and that's
but they were saying no worries here.
No worries here at that particular time. And I had to go with their, they called the shots and that was it. So I said, that's fine. And that's what happened. And then, as Robin will explain to you, like, you know, the intimidation raised its ugly head in the course of the trial, like, you know, which was scandalous.
Yeah, it was on a scale I don't think we've really seen before in a court of law. And even Michael White, who was presiding judge, said it was the most outrageous contempt of court he'd come across. Even before the trial, I think Gardaí did up confidential reports and they'd raised concerns about 12 witnesses who they fear wouldn't come to court because of intimidation. One man living in the border area said he'd be killed if he gave evidence against Aaron Brady. Another witness in America, Ronan Flynn, said that he'd been told that he'd get it and his family would be got if he came forward. And that came up again during the trial, especially in relation to Ronan Flynn. In around May 8th, I think it was, it became clear that a video was circulating of Ronan Flynn. He'd given a witness statement recorded in an NYPD precinct that was given to Aaron Brady in evidence so he could review it before the trial. Aaron Brady, in prison, had somehow snuck in a mobile phone, had recorded this statement, this videoed statement, and had shared it around, accusing Ronan Flynn of being a tout and all sorts of other accusations about him. And that was a clear attempt to intimidate not just Ronan Flynn, but any other witness who thought about giving evidence.
So what happened then?
Ronan Flynn didn't come forward, essentially. There were 7 people in total in America who gave formal statements that Aaron Brady had admitted to shooting Detective Garda Adrian Donoghue. Yeah. Only 2 came forward, 5 didn't for different reasons, but a lot of that was to do with the intimidation. And after the trial, there'd be a separate investigation into Aaron Brady running this, orchestrating this campaign of intimidation.
All right. So then as the trial progressed and you're looking for all those pieces of the jigsaw, you were there reporting on the trial. You know, did you have a sense that they were going to do it?
It's always hard to tell, especially in jury trials. You know, it can be, you can sway one way or the other. There was, you know, fairly strong evidence linking Aaron Brady to the robbery. And if they believed the witnesses who gave evidence of admissions, there was enough to push it over the line for capital murder. But I suppose it's hard to kind of separate yourself. You're hearing the evidence in legal argument that doesn't go before a jury. And that's important to kind of put out there. And that's why it's important to have the book out there as well. There's so much evidence linking Aaron Brady to this murder that was never actually put before a jury. And in spite of all that, them not hearing certain evidence, they still felt they had heard enough in the court to convict him of both robbery and capital murder.
Yeah. Now, there's an intriguing picture in the book. It's a tattoo on Brendan Traynor's back, drawn in 2018, which is 5 years after the murder of Adrian Dunhuugh, depicting imagery linked to the murder and robbery, which prosecutors claimed was actually, strangely and uniquely, I suppose, a pictorial admission.
And a pictorial admission, and that's what was represented by the prosecution to show that he was involved in the robbery.
But he was acquitted.
He was acquitted. But look, that's the way it goes. And how Brendan Traynor came into the picture was very, very... the first armed robbery at Lordship Credit Union, Benny Traynor was the suspect. He was arrested and questioned by Adrian Dunhuugh for that robbery. And then when Aaron Brady and Jimmy Flynn were stopped at the checkpoint the next day and spoken to by John Moroney, the sergeant, we looked at their phones, and one of the first calls they made from the phones was to Benny Traynor. Right. So then that was a red flag for me. Like, this was, like, we have to look at this in more depth, you know.
Well, there's so much in the book. It's already number one, as you mentioned, in the non-fiction charts. Yeah. It's called Murder at Lordship, Inside the Hunt for a Detective's Killer. It's written by Pat Murray and Robin Schiller. And thank you both very much for joining us in studio today.
Thank you.
The Pat Kenny Show.
With Aviva Insurance.
Weekdays at 9 a.m. on News Talk.